Jordan.
I am recording.
Already did that done. Yo.
I think my fridge is louder than usual.
Yay.
Having removed your fridge from the audio, it took 7 passes, so that's kind of amazing.
I can do it
in
kidding?
One.
Well, I could do it in one, but the threat was of it turning you into a robot voice.
No, well, then don't do it with noise removal. If it's a steady low hum, then use a high pass filter. It'll just cut out any frequencies below a certain threshold.
Yeah, it wasn't.
It's a much cleaner way to do it than noise removal.
Yeah, it was a weird sound I was trying to get out.
Hmm.
Because it fluctuated a little bit too.
I don't think I've ever had that problem.
Refrigerator.
Unless there was at some point where my editing made us sound like robots.
That's a cool
no.
sound. Well, it's like the chapter and verse default setting to convert your MP3s is 14 kilobits per second because of iTunes. It's like, why is that
wow.
a good setting?
14 kilobits.
It
what
sounds
would you
as,
even use that for? I
it
mean,
sounds as bad.
Waves?
It sounds as bad as your imagination is possible.
Ugh.
Oh.
Tin cans and a wire.
Sounds like an 8-track playing sticks.
It's terrible.
All right, guys, we're all recording.
We are.
Let's clap.
Hold on.
Okay. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Hi everyone, welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 310. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me today are James Jones.
The big 310.
Guillaume Veillette.
Guillaume Veillette.
Wow. We're in for a fucking episode today, aren't we?
And our return guest, Nate Andrews.
I am volcanically pleased to be here, Johnny.
Thank you so much for helping us out again, Nate.
Nate's reading from Nintendo press releases now or something.
Yeah.
we have listener mail coming up later in the show, and we have some very interesting questions to get to. But first, we're going to do new business, and James is going to kick it off with a game that none of you have heard of, but I guarantee you're going to want to hear him talk about it.
Yeah. So I don't review a lot of stuff for the site anymore. I do occasionally. Stuff pops up. Sometimes I get assigned stuff. It's kind of an ad hoc basis. But
it's as if you built a reputation.
Well, my reviews are stellar. Thank you very much.
You put this upon yourself, though.
Well. So what happened is, so there's an email thread floating around where they're looking for people to pick up eShop review codes. And one of them, you know, I without doing any research, because I never researched the game I'm going to review, I picked up one of them just out of the list that was remaining, and this game happened to be called Crazy Hunter. Now, as soon as I selected this game, I was offered the opportunity to back away gracefully. So I went, oh, fuck, what have I done? But I've committed, so let's go for it.
Is Crazy Hunter the subtitle for Manhunt 3?
I wish. That would be tremendous.
Is it a submarine game?
It would be horrible. No, Crazy Hunter is, first off, it's a DSiWare title that I played on my 3DS because we get our review codes in eShop form. And it is a game about a crocodile named Dundee, just in case you're curious, who apparently is licensed to operate a motorboat. And he has taken it upon himself to knock over candy-constructed towers with what appear to be goats on them, who have stationed themselves throughout the river in which he happens to be operating. And with the expressed intention of using those goats to build a tower to reach a golden chicken sitting in a cloud who is shitting out gold eggs.
Did you take bath salts before the recording?
No. That is the plot of Crazy Hunter. I don't quite comprehend what the hunter part is, but the crazy part makes a hell of a lot of sense.
Yeah, it's very accurate.
It is the even disregarding the fact that 50% of the game's title has nothing to do with the plot, it's still the most accurate title in history.
Well, once you get past crazy, it doesn't really matter.
It's just fucking mental.
This isn't even like a redneck version of like Deer Hunter or something.
Nope.
You know, like I'm like Redneck Rampage.
Nope.
Oh, that game sucked.
I would assume this is like hunting through the jungle, searching for clowns or something really ridiculous like that, but I would not have ever guessed.
No, and you shouldn't have, because honestly, what kind of narcotic requires you to think of, well, this alligator is going to go through a river on what appears to be a piece of cheesecake and knock over towers of candy that have goats on it? I mean, what the fuck? What the fucking fuck? It doesn't make any sense. And I mean, disregarding the fact that he's trying to build a tower to get to a chicken that is sitting on a cloud, whatever, with the intention of becoming wealthy, which is apparently a high crocodilian concern.
Well, maybe. You don't know what he's going to do.
Well, I mean, that's what the trailer shows, let's put it that way. Not that the trailer is in the game, because that would actually require animation, and this game has none of it.
He might just be really into urinating from high places.
It's possible, but
well, he is concussed.
Yeah, I did conclude he must have been concussed by the egg that struck him in the head. But I mean, this game is as bad as you imagine it to be. And I imagine at this point you've concluded it's pretty terrible. So it's got three gameplay modes. One of them is the boat that I mentioned, which controls pretty terribly. But it's so incredibly repetitive and adds so little new content that even if it controlled fine, after about 10 seconds you'd be done with it. Once he's made it upstream, knocking down as many goats as he can without running out of fuel, and of course you get fuel for hitting more goats.
Of course.
The game switches into a second mode, which is a crane game. I'm not kidding. it's like a two-button crane, so you hit stop at one direction, hit stop another, and then he picks up the goat. So it's a crane game to pick up goats, during which you see this incredibly badly animated image of the crocodile working the controls of a crane. And animated in the sense that, like, a Rembrandt is animated. I mean, there's about that much range of motion going on. And then after a few levels of that high action, you play a game where you stack goats to reach the chicken. It is.
Can you win?
No, because you bought this game.
So you lost already?
In theory, yes, yeah. You can reach the chicken. I have done it. It is a sight to not behold. But once you reach said chicken, you just go to a different part of the world, because he apparently has a travel license as well, and apparently has decided he will try to collect other chickens. Now, what I really appreciate about this game, besides its horrific graphics and its tremendously bad audio, is that they actually, the very story conceit, if you can call it that, has two huge, huge gaping plot holes in it. First off, he's trying to get a tower to reach the chicken, never mind the fact that he's knocking goats off of pre-existing towers that he could have just employed.
Again, concussed.
It would have been a much easier solution to his problem, I guess is the word we'd use for it. I don't know.
But preoccupation.
But the second part is that obviously the chicken that is releasing golden eggs is an allusion to the common idiom of the goose that laid the golden egg. Except they got it wrong and made it a chicken. It honestly.
But that's what makes it crazy.
It's like, how did you screw that part up? There's no way they didn't know about the goose that laid the golden egg. Is it possible that the art team, such as it is, was incapable of drawing a goose?
Listen, this is not historically accurate, Hunter.
Could it be cultural differences? Is this game from Scandinavia?
I don't care if this game is from Mars. I mean,
it sounds like it's from the mind of Tracy Jordan on 30 Rock.
It does, actually. Only the alligator would have a horribly racist, like, Song of the South voice going on.
Oh my god.
If there was sound.
Well, so there is sound.
Or if there was good sound.
Well, yeah, so, I point out in the review that there's basically two goat sounds, speaking of which, the goat never moves. It is a static, two-dimensional image in a 3D landscape. It's fucking mental. And there's two goat sounds, the sound of the engine, three songs, maybe, I'm not sure, that are all about as long as a dollar bill, and two horrible garbled noises the alligator makes, and that's it. That's the whole game. Oh, and a monkey that chirps every time you scroll through a letter on the high score screen, which is awful. It's just I'm like, oh my god, shoot me now, please.
I'm a little bit curious now.
I just wanted to write the word sex as my high score and be done with it. But no, the monkey's horrible, horrible noise got in the way. So I was left with saw because I couldn't bear to write the next two letters. Yeah, this is – I mean, the problem with Crazy Hunter is that it's not totally riddled with stupid, insane, crazy bugs. Because if it were, there would be at least some way that one could approximate enjoyment here, even if it's just for the – oh my god, really? But it's just so tremendously, awfully, incredibly dull and boring and so rote and so uninspired and so poorly executed that the fact it doesn't have bugs is actually kind of a disappointment. Like, it's just bad. There's nothing to laugh at, nothing to experience, nothing to even remember about this game except the unrelenting sameness of everything in it. It defies explanation why this game got released.
Unfortunately, James, I think you probably sold a few copies of Crazy Hunter today.
Probably. I mean,
not to me, but someone is going to think I could enjoy this ironically, and maybe they can. That's a superpower that I don't have. Yeah, but
you would really struggle to pull it off because
why?
It's so
why
dull.
Can't I gift you guys copies of Crazy Hunter?
Because the Nintendo felt gifting was dumb. Probably because they caught wind of the fact that I gifted John all kinds of horrible things. Like, enjoy your massage. That was the end of gifting on Nintendo consoles. There was an alert that went off in Kyoto. I'm like, well, that can't happen anymore.
Shut it down.
It's a booby trap in the system. you triggered the self-destruct sequence.
I'm still very thrilled that his wife was in the room when he saw what the game was. It could not have gone better.
Oh, God. Next time I visit John, we have got to bust that out and play some.
Oh, it's Simon Says on the back of horribly drawn women. I mean, that's a terrible game, but at least there's something redeeming there in how terrible it is. If you can't be good, at least don't be boring.
All right, everyone. I know it's been a while, but there is your patented James Jones rant on a terrible, terrible, awful, hilariously misguided game. So we're going to move on, and I figured Nate could go next.
Yeah, I've been playing a different kind of crazy.
That's good.
The good kind.
Yeah, the coherent kind, which is The Walking Dead Episode 4. Which came out earlier this week. I have no like prior affinity for the Walking Dead graphic novels or for the TV show. I don't even like zombies that much as a part of anything. But I think this game is probably one of the best written, best acted experiences that I've had without it actively being a quote-unquote game. It's actually at its worst when it tries to overlay what we might consider traditional game mechanics onto something. For example, in the third episode, there's a moment when it has you manually sniping zombies from around cover, and the margin of error it gives you is pretty ample, but that kind of thing feels like such a compromise, I suppose, from the more thoughtful and emotional, dialogue-driven gameplay that they build around. And there are similar instances in this latest episode, and they're less egregious than the previous episode. But stuff like that still stands in stark contrast to the things that this game does very well and better than most games, actually.
Better than anything, I would say.
But yeah, better than anything in recent memory, at least.
It kind of begs the question, Nate. I mean, I've been playing this as it comes out. I haven't been able to play Chapter 4 yet because I haven't had time this week. Mm-hmm. But Walking Dead is currently maybe my favorite game of the year.
I would definitely agree.
It's just incredibly good.
Yeah.
And I certainly hope that some kind of bundle of all the episodes is on its way to Wii U or something like that, because everyone needs a chance to play this game. It's absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't mind the puzzle solving parts or the bits where you're kind of walking around or you occasionally shoot someone in a really terrible shooting engine.
No, the puzzle stuff I think is fine. It's just when it puts you like directly behind a gun and says, you know, shoot these things yeah. coming toward you, it kind of loses that appeal.
They're kind of like cutscenes where you're just kind of moving
are.
A cursor
yeah, if,
around.
They're no lose situations, you know. If you mess up, you can just start right over. So there's no consequence.
I guess it begs the question, if the other parts of the game are so good, could you make a game that's just that stuff, that's basically all dialogue trees and all talking to people?
Yeah.
And you just, you know, whatever action scenes there are, you just automate them. I mean, to me, like the mashing on the keyboard, I mean, I played on PC, but you, like mashing Q and then at the last second mashing E. That's not fun. Like, I really don't want to do that. It's just kind of stressful, but it doesn't enhance the game for me. I'd rather just watch that stuff so I can enjoy the production of the cutscene.
I think they could have, easily cut that out and just made everything automated, but there's a certain expectation, I think, that they at least have for themselves in terms of making a game.
But a game is a series of decisions, or at least that's one way to make a game.
Yeah.
And the decisions are so juicy and so...
Well, some of it is also the context, you know, the zombie stuff kind of forces their hand, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I the whole idea of The Walking Dead is that these people cannot win, you know, so...
Right, yeah, it's...
Putting them into a bunch of combat situations where they somehow get out of it, to me, it actually undermines the theme a little bit. I would prefer that they just had to run away.
I agree.
And some of them don't make it or whatever. But, like, to me, you know, I understand they're sometimes use the guns against other people, you know. But to me, there shouldn't be these action scenes in the game. I just don't think it needs them.
It's a built-in appeal that it really doesn't need and it doesn't benefit from. The interesting parts are when you're, like, put into... you know, these collapsing situations and choices that are just shitty no matter how you approach them.
And you have about 3 seconds to decide.
Yeah, yeah, it's like, no, you got to choose right now who's going to die.
It's like, how often do you play a video game where you have to make a decision and then after you make it, you think, oh, wow, I really don't know if that was the right thing.
Yeah.
But the game is set up in that it just keeps pushing you forward and you just really don't have time to think about the past, you know, you don't really have time to worry about your mistakes. And that's the characters are going through the same thing. So it really kind of helps put you in the headspace of those characters. I mean, they're just getting by day to day and they really can't dwell on, the fact that their wife died 6 hours earlier. They just have to move on to the next challenge.
And that stuff comes to a head at certain points. So.
Yeah. And sometimes people die and I think, did that person have to die? Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I don't know how I got to this point. I don't know if this was avoidable or, you know, maybe if I had kept them alive, someone else would have had to die on the way who I like even more.
Yeah,
and,
I don't know.
You know, I've heard of people, like, going back through and trying to play it multiple ways, but I feel
I don't think I would do that.
Yeah, just committing to whatever bad decisions you made is part of the game. Like, it's part of the storytelling. So mm-hmm. I think it's best if you just keep pushing forward. Because things are getting shitty no matter what, right?
Yeah. Have you been playing with the notifications on? Like when you make a dialogue choice, it'll say, so-and-so noticed what you did. Or will remember what you did.
No.
Okay, yeah, me too.
I would find that really distracting.
Yeah.
And I don't want to second-guess myself any more than I already am.
Yeah.
You know?
I think something like
that
is...
I don't want that meta, you know, data on it.
Yeah, something like that is just another unneeded accessory.
Yeah. But Walking Dead is ridiculous, and it's really cheap, too. I think I paid $25 for the whole season.
Yeah, I got it on a Steam sale earlier this summer.
Oh, dude, what was that? What was the price on that?
$15.
For the whole thing?
Yeah.
Oh, that's insane.
Yeah, it's...
that's just insane.
I mean, if you think $25 is too much right now, just wait, like, 2 months until the next group of Steam sales. That'll definitely be on there.
Yeah, but you paid that price for a game that's not even finished releasing.
Yeah.
Like, that's not even, like, Bomba territory or, you know, waiting for the game to lose its value and picking it up for a cut-rate price 6 months later. Mm-hmm. That game's not even technically finished and out yet, and you picked it up for an insane price.
Yeah, I think that was probably only one episode in, and by that point I was so convinced.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, I'm going to see this all the way through.
It's incredible. And I'm with you. I don't even like zombie shit. I don't even like Telltale games. I don't really like the other stuff that they've done. Don't care. I don't like the Walking Dead TV show that much.
Nope.
Doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. The game is so good. It's so incredibly good that you have to play it.
Yeah, episode 4 has some gut punch moments.
Oh, it's boy.
Done really well.
Yeah. I got that to look forward to this weekend.
Yeah.
It's like every episode is about 2 hours long, and that is about as long as I could imagine playing the game in one session. Because it's so harrowing. So what else you've been playing?
So I've been playing something that's not so depressing, which is Pushmo, since Crashmo was revealed recently. You should read Aaron's impressions on the site if you haven't already. Pushmo is so good. It's basically been like my comfort food throughout the past week, especially after trudging through The Walking Dead. I would take a break every once in a while to, like, you know, just do a puzzle or something. And it's kind of the opposite experience, because in Pushmo, I could start a puzzle and just kind of like mess around for a while and stumble on a solution at some point and have a good time doing everything. With The Walking Dead, it's like, no, you got to choose right now. Who's going to, you know, get a grisly fucking death right now?
The Pushmo is no consequences.
Yeah, absolutely not.
Well, you guys clearly haven't unlocked the expert levels.
No, I haven't.
I don't know how far I am. I played it a lot, but I got to a point where it felt like every single level that I got to was surgery. I mean, it was like I could get through it eventually, but it would take hours, and it was just like really kind of painful to get through it. I had to try about 100 different things before I found something that worked. And I was like,
I am so glad that you are not a surgeon.
Don't worry, we'll get through this surgery eventually.
I'll figure it out.
Let me try this.
Put it back in.
Let's press reset.
Oh, what's this extra part over here?
Rewind.
Yeah, Crashmo, man, that's exciting that's coming out so soon.
I really question Nintendo's naming conventions at this point.
Oh, whatever.
Well, yeah. Pushmo's not very good either, so.
No, it's not. You know, maybe, I mean, I know I'm alone here, but that, I mean, it just, that game never really got to me. I just felt like it was way too easy for way too long. And by the time it got even, like, a modicum of challenge, I was done with it.
Yeah, but it's a Nintendo puzzle game.
Yeah,
they're all that
way. It's like
way.
Picross is the same way. You just play through this boring shit for so long, but eventually you kind of.
I lost patience with it though. There should just be like a yes, I understand the fucking concept of pushing blocks around. Let me skip the first 20 levels.
You have to earn it.
It's. I don't want to earn it. I don't want to deal with that.
You have to.
Well, then I'm not going to buy Crash Mode. Then when they say, what was it, 96 training levels? No.
Yeah, it's a little grindy. It's
go
just
to
a,
hell!
It's a little too hand-holdy. And, you know, on the other hand, it eventually gets insanely hard. But I agree with you, James. I mean, it takes way too long to get there. And the mandatory tiered structure, I'm not a fan of. I think they should give you more flexibility in the order that you play these things.
Yeah, I mean, because the first 20 are not even, I mean, like, they're not even mindless. They're less than that.
Yeah.
It's just like, just do something, please.
Yeah, but it's so richly rewarding when you get through that stuff and you get to the real kind of chunky center of the game. Unfortunately, I just got beyond the chunky center and I got into the, you know, hard as nails, awful stuff at the end. But some people love that and dig into it. And I'm just like, you know, I just always do the 80-20 rule. Like, I've seen 80% of this game. I'm okay moving on now. But
yeah.
You know, I still have it. I'll probably go back to it at some point. But I am excited for Crash Mode just because I'm interested to see them throw in some new mechanics and sort of start me back over at the simpler stuff that I can digest and then, you know, get back into the middle again.
Well, I guess you lost all your saves though, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh no.
Fun
I've
stuff.
Got Mutant Muds to look forward to, and you know, the DLC for that, the free DLC. Which actually I'm not going to take credit for it, but I think I was on the same parallel line of thinking as Jules Watchsome when we talked to him at E3, and I said, you know, the problem with unlocking Granny at the end of Mutant Muds is that, you know, she has all the abilities at once, so she's like super powered, but at that point you've already played everything in the game, So there are no challenges left. You have no reason. You have no impetus to actually combine these abilities that you've learned to use in this new character and do something with it. So I'm just really excited that they've put out these 20 new free levels where you, that is exactly what you do. It's all like, here, do this stuff that you could not do with the main character. You can only do it with Granny. And that's going to be awesome. Yep. Really excited for that. And that's like, if you think about it, that's something they really don't need to do. Because usually when you would release some kind of free DLC, if you think about like the Burnout Paradise and stuff like that, mm-hmm. they add that stuff to keep you from reselling the game. But Mutant Muds is only available as a digital right. download, so no one can resell it anyway. So the only reason that they would do this is, I mean, they're going to generate some renewed interest and sell a few extra copies of it. But mostly, they're just giving free stuff to people who've already paid for their game. Yeah. And you know, I just think it's a really nice gesture, and it's, you know, probably is good promo for the sequel, but that hasn't even been announced yet, really. So we don't know how far off that is.
Isn't there a port coming too, though? I mean,
there was a port to PC already.
Yeah, I thought there was another port coming though, or something like that.
Oh, it is coming to Wii U.
The Wii U,
yeah. port. So this might be good promo for that as well.
I guess so, but surely to different people. I mean, the Wii U game is basically the same thing, so...
Yeah, oh yeah, I
can't imagine
thing.
That people are going to double dip all that much.
No, I was thinking just keep it, you know, on the media line every so often.
Yeah.
We're being
maybe that's
spoon-fed this story.
Yeah.
We will take it.
Cool. All right, well, Guillaume is up next with new business.
All right, well, I'm happy to say that I will continue this trend of all of us really enjoying what we've been playing.
Good.
Oh, good.
and following my adventures last week with Final Fantasy V, I was a little bit bummed out because I was really set on playing an old school RPG, and that didn't happen. And oh yeah, a precision that I must make: the game crashes even if you have the disc version from the anthology that was released for the PlayStation 1.
Yes.
Really.
So, yeah, you're boned no matter what. The big problem...
So it is accurately emulated.
Exactly.
We have emulated all of the bugs.
They knew about this bug for a long time, I assume, but they were like, well, whatever, we'll still sell it on a piece of hardware that can't play it.
Well, the upshot is your horror story got me to order a copy from Amazon of the GBA version, and it's here. So I haven't started yet, but very soon I'm super excited to play that.
Sweet. I'd like to do the same, but I'm kind of not buying games at the moment in preparation for the Wii U. I do have the disc version, and I hear that if you play the game on the PlayStation 2, you've got the graphical glitches, but you don't have the crashes.
Oh. That doesn't make any sense.
I know. I
Sony, what the fuck?
Well, you know, you've got the PlayStation 2, PlayStation 2 Slim, the PlayStation 3, the PlayStation 3 that didn't play PlayStation 2 games anymore, which is what I have.
And these all have different chipsets.
I know.
Yep.
They're all distinct hardware
pointless.
Releases.
Why do you keep doing this to yourself?
I have a PSP Go, but there was the PSP, PSP 2000, 3000.
Uh-huh.
They got up to like 6, didn't they?
I don't know. I don't care. but anyway, so I didn't have any backup old school RPG to play, but I was I did have Persona 3 Portable on my PSP. And I had been waiting to start that game because I had played Persona 4 a while ago. I had loved it, but I thought, I need a break from this. And the break turned out to be longer than I thought because apparently I bought 3 2 years ago when it was on sale. Mm-hmm. I didn't plan on shelving it for that long, but I'm righting that wrong right now. Hmm. I remember back when I was, you know, dipping my toes in the Persona waters, I had asked on various message boards, okay, so I see Persona 3 FES for $40 and Persona 4 for $50. I only want one. Which one should I get? And everyone loudly and unanimously said, you must get Persona 4.
Yeah.
Everyone seemed to agree that it was the way superior game. And now that I've started 3, I have to agree. It is definitely it's better in basically every way. Like the characters were more interesting to me. The plot was more engaging. But Persona 3 is still a whole lot of fun. I just, it's perhaps not quite as clever as 4 was, but it still has the same elements for the most part that I really loved in 4. And I'm just psyched to have, you know, another one of these games to play on the go.
Guillaume, I know Persona is a fairly well-known series among gamers, but I've never played any of them. And you called it like an old school RPG, but
no, I said I was out of, I didn't have a backup old school RPG. This is not old school at all.
I see. So then is Persona more like, and I mean, it is a newer Japanese RPG, but there aren't many things to compare it to in that, you know, in that category. So, what does it feel like? I mean, does it remind you of like old Super Nintendo RPGs, or is it more like a, you know, a Final Fantasy on PlayStation or PS2?
All right, here we go. I'm sure that other, you know, more hardcore RPG fans would have more things to compare it to, or anime fans would seriously have more to compare it to, but my reference points are kind of limited. Persona 3 and 4, the whole series, really, usually take place in Japan, in modern-day Japan, and it's usually a group of students who find themselves with the ability to summon demons to fight other demons.
Real Japanese history.
Yes. And so Persona 3 starts out as you're going, you know, you're moving to this dorm, to this new school, and as you get off the train, you realize that everything is kind of weird, and the electricity doesn't seem to work. Everyone seems to be gone. You see these strange coffin-looking things mm-hmm. strewn around, and you get to your dorm, and some enigmatic boys greets you and tells you to sign this contract, and then goes away. And then everything seems like time seems to move forward again, and then you meet the people at your dorm, and it just seems like a weird moment that passed. But then there is you realize that something is wrong when the people in your dorm keep asking you questions about, like, hey, did you notice anything strange last night? And, you know, they quiz you about these things. But in the meantime, you go to school, you make new friendships, I suppose, you answer questions in class. And you know this is a Japanese game, because if you answer correctly questions in class, that increases your charm stat.
yeah.
And you can decide to spend your time studying and or going to do karaoke to increase your courage stat. You know, like it. Uh-huh. That part of the game seems to be some sort of time management thing.
Yeah, it's a social thing.
Yeah, yeah. And at some point, the actual game, you know, kicks off, and some demon is attacking your dorm, and the people at your dorm tell you, okay, go hide with this other girl, and we're gonna take care of things. And you presume that they're fighting the monster, but apparently the monster is going right for you. You're on the roof, and the girl starts summoning this demon and starts fighting the creature, but she's overpowered. And let me know if you've ever seen this before. you pass out, and you summon your own demon, which goes berserk and saves everyone. It is very, very anime Evangelion. Anyway, so yeah, there's a lot of anime tropes in there, but I find the setting really, really refreshing. I find just the idea that you don't have your usual crew of like the sarcastic bard and the adventurer and the princess and the pirate mm-hmm. as you know, just like last week, and instead you have like the, well, yeah, anime cliches, but still, like, it's so unusual to see in an RPG that it feels refreshing. I've already I've already explained the kind of social sim thing that goes on for, you know, throughout the game, but occasionally you might want to go to visit this thing called the Tartarus, mm-hmm. This giant tower in the middle of it's not Tokyo, it's some fictitious Japanese city, but let's call it Tokyo. So this giant tower that appears during the dark hour, the time between one day and the next, that everyone, during which everyone or most people transmogrify into coffins, and people like you, just, you know, who can summon personas, apparently, you know, stay awake through and fight these shadows, these monsters. Mm-hmm. So you can decide to explore this tower, and as you try to go higher and higher, that's more the classic RPG gameplay. You fight monsters that you can see on the map, which is very appreciated. You can attack them from behind. If you can surprise them, you get you know, the advantage. You can strike first, which I always like. And the combat itself is really, really fast-paced. It's very, very quick. You can analyze the enemy's weaknesses. Usually when you hit them with their weakness, they're stunned. And if you can stun all the enemies on the screen, you get to do an all-out attack, which is basically like this very cartoony...
Dust cloud,
yeah. You see like just onomatopoeias, you know, bam, thump, pow, coming out and...
limbs everywhere.
Yep, and it's just, it's really, really funny, really, really high energy, you know, very, very cartoony and fun.
Aren't these games like 100 hours long?
No.
Yeah, there's a lot to do if you want.
Sure, yeah, but that's one of the things that I like about the game. I mean, I had stayed away from the whole Shin Megami Tensei thing because, you know, my philosophy has always been, okay, if they don't want me to pronounce it, they probably don't want me to play it. And so I was really intimidated by the series in general. But Persona has turned out to be surprisingly approachable. You're never really wondering exactly what it is that you're supposed to do. And there are complex elements, but it's very easy to grasp the battle system. There's this whole kind of Pokemon-like element to the game where you catch personas and fuse them. And it is somewhat required, but it's not complicated. I mean, I'm sure that there are people who do really get into that stuff and try to maximize their stats and try to get the best combinations. But, you know, I just do what feels right, and I look at the stats very quickly, and I'm like, oh, okay, this looks good. And then I do a couple of fusions, and okay, so now I got the demon that I need. It's got a light attack, so now I can do these light attacks against enemies that are weak against light. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really not rocket science.
Cool.
And so...
Sounds good.
I would say, like, it's a shame that this series is not on Nintendo systems. But I gotta say, like, I haven't really tried any of the other Shin Megami Tensei series. Mm-hmm. But there are a couple on DS.
James knows all about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm now kind of a little bit more open to trying them out. They still, I don't know why I'm still kind of intimidated by the whole series. But especially now that Shin Megami Tensei 4 is coming out for the 3DS, I find myself looking forward to it a little bit more.
At one time there was a Persona game, sort of unknown, unspecified Persona game announced for 3DS, but then Atlas hasn't really said anything about it in a couple of years, so we don't know if it's been canceled or maybe they just decided to wait and do something later. But, you know, with 3DS, like, stomping all over Vita in Japan... it seems kind of inevitable that this might happen eventually.
Yeah, I just want to say, if you've got a Vita and you're wondering what to play on it, you have, and you haven't played Persona 4 before, you have to get the enhanced version that's coming out pretty soon.
Definitely.
Because it is definitely the superior game. And if you have only a PSP, do give Persona 3 a go. I mean, it's not as good, but it's still... I'm sure that if you liked what I described, you'll dig it.
Yeah,
cool.
I think the earlier first two Personas, the PS1 games, are also on the PSN service.
Oh yeah, but I tried the first one for like a total of 10 minutes.
Yeah,
and it looks horrible. It's got an awesome opening animation, but then you've got these terrible isometric graphics where you talk to people and run around, and then the game is in first person and it's very easy to get lost in.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe once I finish 3, but we'll see.
Alrighty. Well, I will wrap up new business because I've been playing a lot more of La Mulana. And, you know, this is a game, when I first downloaded it, I got really frustrated at the beginning. I talked about it on the show, and I was worried I might have made a mistake, or you know, then I when I went on the internet and I sort of saw how poorly I was playing the game and learned a little bit about the correct way, I was worried that the rest of the game might be like that, you know, where I would bang my head on the wall for hours and hours, and I'd go and watch the internet and, you know, get some hint that would help me push forward, and that would be the only way I'd ever make progress. And thankfully, that is not true, and actually, I've been able to play several hours of the game. I think I've played for about 8 hours now. I'm not nearly finished with it because it's huge, way bigger than I even, like, even last night I was playing it pretty late last night, and I found a new item that opens up many new areas of the game that I didn't even know existed before. So the game is actually way longer than I thought it was just an hour earlier playing the game. Hmm. So I think it's an incredible value. I still love the graphics and the music, but the really nice, pleasant surprise for me is that once I got over that initial learning curve, which is pretty steep, but once I got over that, I found that the game is very approachable and very easy to understand. I mean, it has a lot of cryptic elements, but they're intentionally cryptic because they're puzzles. You know, you're not meant to understand everything the first time you see it. But the great thing about La Mulana is that it opens up so much. It's very nonlinear, and it opens up so much that even if you get to a place that just seems way too hard, or you've been to every room and you can't figure out what you haven't done yet, and you don't understand how to open that treasure chest, you just don't get it, or you found a boss who's way too difficult. Like, I've done everything in this area. I can get to the boss, but I can't beat the boss. Damn it. It's okay, because there's lots of other places you can go. It's just a huge world that you can explore. And at any given time, there's a lot of different things that you can try to do. There's a lot of different places. There's probably 2 or 3 places that you went into and died, or went into and then got scared and retreated, and you just haven't gone back to them yet. So it's not like there was something there that you just absolutely couldn't get past. It's just, you got distracted by another opportunity, and you can always go back to it. And that's worked out really great for me. And I've needed very little help on the game ever since that initial burst. And I have just been having an amazing time with it. It's a game that I can sit down and play for hours at a time and just get really engrossed in it. And, you know, sometimes you go out and you kind of venture into the ruins, you take a lot of damage, and it doesn't feel like you made that much progress before you have to go back to the surface and heal up and save. But I've never found that I played the game for, you know, a long time and didn't feel like I made much progress. Actually, it's the opposite. It's like, I feel like every time I go in there, not only do I learn more about what's going on, not only do I learn more about how to play the game better, but I actually find something that's, it might be minor, but it's enough to make me feel like I can keep going, you know? And so, yeah, I mean, the game is very challenging, but it's not brutal. I don't think that would be fair to say. I think it's actually very fair, and it gives you so many options that it actually made me, last night I was playing, and it made me think a little bit of like a Mega Man game. You know, when you first start a Mega Man game, you have all these options. You have 8 levels that you can choose from, and they're all fucking brutally difficult. But you try them out and you figure out which one seems the easiest, relatively speaking. And you work at it 2 or 3 times until you master a few of the challenges in there and you get to the boss, and then the boss wipes the floor with you. And then you go back to the boss, and this time you're a little better prepared. You know the patterns, maybe you brought an energy tank, something like that. And you go in there and you try something different and it works, and now you have his power. And now all the other levels are the same as they were before, but you're different. And now you figure out what's the next weakest point that I can attack here, until eventually, one by one, you break down every area of the game. And that's exactly the feeling I get from La Mulana. It's not exactly the same structure. There's not like a level select here. It's more of a continuous world that you explore. But you have so many different choices at all times to go try, and they're all hard, but one of them is a little less hard than the other ones. And you just have to go find that, you clear that area out, and then now you have new powers, you have new items, you have a new understanding of the world, and now you can go and the whole landscape is shifted a little bit because you're not the same character that you were before. You have these different powers. Mm-hmm. So it's just wonderful. It's exactly the kind of game that I love. And I was hoping that it would be, and then I wasn't sure at first, and then, you know, now I'm way deep into it, and I can't recommend it highly enough. I mean, if you have a little bit of patience, and if you have a love for these kind of classic 16-bit style action games with lots of exploration, some puzzle solving, plenty of combat, really cool music and graphics, and it's just fantastic. Lots of character progression. It's not an RPG, but it's more like a Zelda or a Mega Man game where you're constantly finding items that give you new powers. And then you can go back to places you've been before. Sorry, James. You can go back to places you've been before and approach them in a completely different way.
You mentioned Mega Man, but I'm just picturing Metroid right now. Is it anything like that?
It has elements of both. Yeah. Hmm. But in Metroid, there's usually one correct way to go. You may not be sure what it is at first, but in Metroid, there's always things blocking your way that keep you from going sort of down the wrong path or getting into a section of the world that you're not really supposed to be yet. And La Mulana feels less gated in that way. It feels like at any given time, there's way more different things for you to try. But I mean, yeah, there's absolutely some Metroid DNA in this game, and that's, you know, no small part of why I'm enjoying it.
That sounds awesome.
It's just fantastic. And like hardly anybody's talking about it. It's not getting much attention, but dear God, it is so good. I really hope people will try it out. And it's, like I said, it's a huge game. I mean, for $10, there's a lot to chew on here, and even more than I thought before. So I'm just thrilled. I can't wait to spend another 10 hours with this game.
Cool.
Yeah, man, it's great. So another thing I wanted to mention this week, because I know a couple of you guys have experienced this and talked about it a little bit, but our old friend Dan Bloodworth did me a solid and sent me a copy of FTL.
Yeah.
And I've been playing that on my PC, and you know, I will stand behind that. I kind of wish this game was on the eShop. I would love to play this as a portable game, and I think it would totally work. I mean, it's not much to look at, you know? I mean, I think it would it's mostly menu-based. I think it would work perfectly on a DS or a 3DS system, and I would prefer to have it be something I could sort of play while other things are going on, you know? Or, you know, because it's kind of low-attention gaming. I mean, it follows these set patterns, and as you sort of blaze your trail through the galaxy and encounter one after another horrible circumstance. It like a lot of the text in the game is repetitive, and so once you've played it two or three times, you start clicking through things a little faster. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's more about what am I going to see that's different that I've never seen before, and it doesn't take that long to get to it, but I feel like this is a game that would just work really nicely as a portable that you could just sort of carry around and, you know, maybe do while your attention is somewhat divided. It feels a little silly to me sitting in front of my big, expensive, loud gaming PC and playing this thing that, you know, looks sort of like an NES game. And doesn't require any reflexes or anything. It's just kind of like clicking on menu options.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I do the same thing, but I do what you said, which is, you know, do something else while I play. But I can see where you would want to, you know, like, have that on the go.
And you know, I don't know. I mean, it's made by, like, two people, so I don't know how realistic it is to expect ports and things like that, but...
They got a lot of money to make that, so I don't know if that's out of the question, but with the success the game's had... So far, I mean, I would love to see it.
It'd be really sweet, you know, see like FTL Special Edition for 3DS or something. It's a really cool game. It is no doubt a really cool game, and it is hard as balls. I mean, I'm playing on easy, and It ain't that easy, man. I did finally, a couple days ago, finally get to the main capital ship at the end.
And what happened?
Actually, the first encounter I had with him, I managed to, I thought, defeat him.
Nope.
It turns out he takes a certain amount of damage and then he runs away and you chase after him. And the second time, oh boy.
And he's got another time after that.
Didn't last long. So, yeah, unfortunately, there's multiple forms of the boss at the end of the game. But, you know, even that was my longest playthrough because I actually got the farthest, you know. But even then, I think that sitting was like maybe half an hour. Maybe it might have been 45 minutes on the real outside. But that's what's nice about the game is, you know, there aren't many games where I can sit down and play it for half an hour and feel like I got a complete experience. And it's not a throwaway thing. It's not Bejeweled either, where it's just kind of like trashy gaming where I don't even have to think about it. And, you know, I get to the end. I don't even remember what I just did because it's so, you know, random and repetitive. FTL is like really the opposite of that because it does have this kind of narrative structure where it's piecing together all these little stories that feel like they add up into more of this kind of journey that you take, which is great. But the lovely thing is it's just so bite-sized still that you can just sort of play two or three times in a row even and feel like it didn't take that much time. And that's really a nice feeling. And even though it is brutally hard, it's so interesting. And the game is full of so many possibilities. It's like, what if I had done this and this and this a little bit differently? Or what if I've made, you know, what if I had chosen to buy this equipment instead of that equipment? And it's just set up in a way that even when you fail spectacularly, immediately you just want to try it again and try a whole different set of things. And that's a sign of a really quality game. I mean, I know some people have compared it to Oregon Trail, and I think that's hilarious, but also kind of a nice comparison in that, I mean, this is a far, far better game than Oregon Trail. Don't get me wrong. But it does capture that feeling of when we were kids and we played Oregon Trail, which is that the game is basically a series of decisions. You know, there's not that much action gameplay to Oregon Trail. There's not that much freedom even. It's mostly in the setup, and then along the way you make, you know, occasionally someone gets sick and you decide what to do with them. And that is very similar to FTL. But in this game, it feels like you have so much more agency. I mean, there's so many more things that you can try. Maybe most of them don't work, but something will, you know, and over time you feel like you get a better grasp on, if I get into this kind of situation, here's the best way to get out of it. Or maybe I should buy these things first because they're the most useful over the long term. And there's no way you would know that the first time you play through the game, but over time you do get better at it. So it's really, really cool. Okay, so that's going to wrap up new business. Now we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we've got your listener mail.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
First up this week, we've got a review for Spy Hunter on 3DS by Neil Ronahan. It's Spy Hunter! Spy Hunter! Ridge Racer references aside, Neil has a review of the latest reboot to the Spy Hunter franchise. For a fleeting moment, Midway rises from the Gwei.
It's tremendous when you have more reboots, or almost as many reboots as you do entries in the series.
Yeah, really. We've also got a review of the hotly anticipated and completely unnecessary Pokemon Black and White version 2 by Andy Gergen. I think this is actually Andy's first Pokemon game. He says, Nintendo found a way to make a new Pokemon game without making new Pokemon. Andy's okay with that, but without the addition of 100 new species, it's not known how to get your fix for totally befuddling Bulbapedia trivia, such as, in Pokemon Diamond and Pearl, Sudowoodo, along with Skunk Tank, Togekiss, Fearow, and Yanma weighs as much as the male protagonist of the game.
That's like my favorite thing to do when I'm bored. Just go find Bulbapedia and read totally random trivia. We also have a feature this week, Japan eShop Roundup by Danny Bivens. Remember that haunting bit during Nintendo Directs where Mii versions of Japanese pop mob AKB48 appeared on the screen? Yeah. Well, it's almost time for AKB48 48 and me to release, which means hope is now fading for an Awada me making an appearance with the girls, unless perhaps it's in this week's eShop video. We also have a blog, NBA 2K13 Help Wanted, by, again, Andy Gergen. Reflecting on his long history with NBA video games, Andy laments that last year's entry in the 2K series was a bit too simulation-heavy, and did a poor job explaining the games who don't get the intricacies of basketball. Here's hoping 2K13 is better, but given recent sports games, probably not. We also have a review of Rhythm Hunter Harmonite from Don Koopman. More Game Freak as we have a review of their newest game, a game where you hit things with a magical music note. It's Harmonite, because it's harmony plus night. It's two words put together, just in case you weren't sure.
We have a review, Samurai G on the 3DS eShop by Josh Max. Get on your golden mode and start slashing ninjas in the side-scrolling action game from UFO Interactive. Aren't those the guy who brought us Ninja Bread Man?
They are!
And in spite of that, it's apparently good. And we have another feature, Steph Says Number 9, Fall Anticipation. It's almost time for the Wii U and the staff is excited. Are you excited? Get excited! We pulled our staff. They're totes excited.
So excited. We have Crashmo Impressions by Aaron. If you love Pushmo, well, now you have Crashmo, and Nintendo let us play it a bit early. Go read, but first read 90 tutorial impressions before you get to the good part. We also
maybe
have...
Maybe they're optional.
Nope, not optional. We also have Fluidity Spin Cycle Impressions by Aaron. Nintendo let us play this one early, too. It's sequel season in Download Land, and apparently things are about to get wet.
Alright, so you can go check out all of this great original content over at NintendoWorldReport.com, and while you're there, be sure to subscribe to NWR Connectivity, because that's the feed, the podcast feed, where you will hear 21 short mini-episodes about our favorite games for the Wii platform, first-party and third-party. That is a great accompaniment to the feature articles on those lists that you've already read about on NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back to the show, everyone. It is time for listener mail. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Or you can go to the show notes for this episode and click the link there to send us an email, just like these people. And James is going to read the first email this week.
Oh, am I? Good. DeJarvis writes, I was listening to a recent episode of Invisible Walls, and they were discussing people's mixed reaction to the recent Resident Evil 6 scores and how mixed the reviews had been. One of the guys said that this was because reviewers have had a preconceived idea or expectation out of the game, and that they weren't taking the game for what it was, a good action game. Some of the other guys counter-argued this by saying how Resident Evil should be a horror game, and if it's not going to be like the old Resident Evil games, that it shouldn't have had the Resident Evil in it. I think this brings up an interesting point when it comes to Nintendo games. If we look back at Metroid Other M, we can see the same divide in both reviews and what fans slash gamers thought of the game. We can even see this divide when it comes towards topics like Mario Sunshine and Zelda Skyward Sword. I understand a lot of it is based on opinion, but what do you guys think on the matter? Since most of you have reviewed or are reviewing games, do you think a game score should be based on what you expected from it and what the franchise has given you in the past? Or should the game be judged as a standalone without other games in the franchise or previous entries in said series?
Well, it just so happens we have a couple of former reviews editors on the show this week.
So let me take this one.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So, well, to answer his question, I would say no. I don't think your expectation of a game should, you know, write the review. I think it's fine to be disappointed by a game if it doesn't live up to whatever standards you have for the series, like Resident Evil. And that's your right. But your personal disappointment shouldn't be the only thing that you're basing a review off.
I just think that if you start looking for reasons to dismiss other people's, you know, opinions that you don't agree with instead of trying to understand where they come from, you're a huge jackass, and you should stop that immediately.
Wow.
That's just what I want to get out there.
James.
Uh-huh.
And James says, your opinion is wrong.
To be fair, there are opinions that are wrong.
I haven't played Resident Evil 6. I will never play Resident Evil 6.
No.
I didn't even like Resident Evil 5 at all, which is really disappointing considering how much I love the fourth game in the series. Mm-hmm. But, when I was reviews editor for this site, which I did for a number of years, I firmly believe that you should review the game for what it is. Sure. And if the game is a bad game, then that's what you should say. And all these other things can give context. They can explain the prism through which you personally approach the game.
If
you're a huge fan of the series and this one's really different, it really kind of threw you off, that's fine to mention that. But if the game is clearly going for something different than the previous ones in the series, then I think you should respect that and then evaluate it based on these new rules that it's setting down for itself. And I think the problem with RE6 is that it tries to be an action game, and it's a really bad action game.
Yeah, it's trying to be all things to all people, and I think the critical consensus, at least what I've read, is that the things that it does to get to that end are all pretty clumsy.
Yeah.
I gotta say, well, maybe like none of us really is interested in Resident Evil 6, so I think that an even better example would be Metroid Prime Hunters. Because there is a game that was called Metroid Prime in the title, but then it turns out to be more of an FPS. And I remember there was this one guy on this forum who was just vilifying people who didn't like the game. He was like, oh, like these purists don't like the game just because it's not enough like Metroid Prime. And that is just silly, you know? Like, it is a valid reason to not really be into the game. I mean, sure. If you're looking for Metroid Prime and you get Hunters, you're not getting Metroid Prime. I mean, you're not getting the elements that you probably buy Metroid games for. And beyond that, I mean, if you compared Metroid Prime Hunters to other FPS games, not on the DS, there were legitimate complaints to be had. It was not the cream of the crop, in my opinion. And it seemed to only borrow the superficial elements of the Metroid series.
It kind of looks like Metroid, but it doesn't really play like Metroid. And, you know, that is that's the choice of the people who made the game, you know, Nintendo Software Technologies and Nintendo of America, who published it. And, I think that they do set themselves up for these comparisons and mm-hmm. in some cases negative comparisons because mm-hmm. There's a cost associated with using a title from a series. You know, I mean, you're trying to associate yourself with the very popular and extremely highly regarded Metroid Prime franchise. And, and then the game turns out to be something very different. And that is going to confuse some people. It's going to anger some people. And it is sort of intentionally misleading in some senses. I think it's fair to say that. But at the same time, I think you have to look at, I think a reviewer should be intelligent enough and professional enough to look beyond things like marketing, which a game's title is a form of marketing, to look beyond that and say, what is this game really? And is it good at what it does?
Yeah,
and I mean, I reviewed Metroid Prime Hunters, and my abstract says it all. Hunters is a fantastic multiplayer FPS, but we're still waiting for the first Metroid game on DS. I gave it a very positive review, and I thought, as a first-person shooter, it's quite good at what it does. But I think people should know that this is not a Metroid game in spirit, and that I think you should be aware of that before you go buy it. But that doesn't make it a bad game.
Sure. I would say that for me, in the very, very tight case we're discussing of Resident Evil 6, I mean, for me, what I saw most telling was the comment that Resident Evil 6 makes Resident Evil 5 feel like Resident Evil 4.
Yeah.
Yikes.
I don't think people are discounting it because it's not what they wanted. Although I think, especially in this case, I mean, Metroid Prime Hunters, Metroid Prime's in the title. But, I mean, at the very least, it has sort of this spin-off-y subtitle thing going on. This is a numbered chronology in a series.
Sure.
It looks so much like Metroid Prime that you could easily think, well, it's the same structure.
Yeah, maybe, but this is literally saying I am part of the same series. So I would say it is pretty much the responsibility of reviewers to delineate that this is not what you were expecting if you're expecting a Resident Evil game. Like, it's more so than just whether or not it affects their score one way or another. They have a certain obligation to educate their readers that, hey, heads up, this isn't what you're expecting.
Yeah.
But I would say that I mean, based on the reviews I've seen, it's just not a good game. I mean, it's not it doesn't do the stuff that it sets out to do particularly well. I mean,
no.
I wouldn't say it's necessarily polarizing. I would say that there are people who can forgive the issues they see with it and those who can't. I mean, a couple reviewers I saw who gave it rough scores later posted on their Twitter accounts that they had been directed to some like weird guide written by some backroom shadowy people who found ways to make the games more enjoyable, but none of this stuff's mentioned in the gameplay. So I think it's like, well, if all this stuff to make the game more playable maybe does improve the experience a bit, but the game doesn't tell you, you know, fuck it. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it's not there. I mean,
Show me a game review that complains that RE6 is not survival horror, and I'll show you a bad game review. That is just not a good way to write or review a game. I think that's a legitimate opinion. If you're lamenting the fact that survival horror games don't get made anymore, or that the series went in this direction, say that in an editorial or on a podcast. But that should not be part of your review. You should review the game that you're reviewing. It's a very simple principle.
Well, what would you say though if it was more the writer giving context to where they've been with the series? If they were discussing the series transition.
I just think you should make it very clear that that's not factoring into your evaluation.
No, taking all that into account, like the game's history and the history of the series, that's useful if you want to have like a more critical, thoughtful discussion. I mean, that's a good tool to have.
Like if you're discussing like how you come to the series,
sure.
You want to give some notion about where you're coming from. I mean, if it doesn't, as long as you're not saying I'm going to torpedo the fuck out of this game's score because it's not a survival horror game. I mean, that's one thing. We're saying, like, you know, this is a series known for being survival horror. This isn't it.
Yeah, and the problem in some cases, and this is really, you could genericize this to any game that kind of defies your expectations. You know, they take something in a totally different direction. You know, I think part of it is that if you're not really clear about whether or not this kind of thing affects the review, then people will get the wrong idea. You know, if people are walking away with your review feeling like you didn't like that game because you don't like that genre, or because the series went in a different direction that you don't like, then I think you haven't done your job very well. You should be really clear that I'm reviewing the particulars of this game for what it is on its own terms.
Feedback.
If you're ambiguous about it, then you're giving fanboys and people, you know, who don't even care to interpret things that they read on the internet, you're just giving them ammunition, and you're feeding a sort of a story that is really unhealthy. You know, I think the story of the way people are criticizing this game, I mean, if the game is a bad game, then that should be the story.
Right.
You know, it should be very clear that that's what you think. And if you're not clear about that, then you should go back and rewrite your review. And I mean, in terms of, you know, in terms of Other M, you know, I like that game, but my problem with it is that the storytelling is really bad.
Yeah.
I think actually, even as a Metroid game, Other M is pretty good. It's not my favorite in the series by a long shot, but I think it does what it does quite well. With a few, you know, really bad first person, like, you know, pointy puzzle things. But my main problem with that game is that the story is really horrible and there's way too much of it. And it really interferes with the rest of the game and your enjoyment of it. But, you know, it's not that they took that game in a direction I didn't like. I thought it was a cool, innovative, sort of fresh look at Metroid. So I had no problem with that. It was more the execution. I think most people felt that way, you know. Okie doke. So, Nate has the next letter in this very Nate-filled segment.
Yeah, what's up with that? Yeah, anyway, Nathan from Toronto writes, just finished looking at yet another review for New Super Mario Bros. 2. There seems to be a trend where gamers have begun to equate the ease of obtaining extra lives with a game's difficulty. Truth be told, Nintendo has been throwing one-ups at us since Mario Galaxy, but I don't think that would categorize either Galaxy game, as easy games to breeze through, particularly in later levels. I'm thinking in particular of the level Luigi's Purple Coins, which is a doozy. And I don't care how good you are.
I'm great.
He doesn't care. To keep things simple, more lives or more chances at a stage do not make the stage easier. Every kid on the playground knew the trick in Super Mario Bros. That would let you instantly restart the level if you were to get a game over screen. This trick let players effectively have unlimited tries at conquering a challenge without having to restart. Yet no one would say that this, or the unlimited lives trick in 3-1, made the game a pushover. Donkey Kong Country Returns, renowned for its difficulty, let you buy lives by the bucket load. No one said a word. I say that any review that includes comments on difficulty should speak to just that, the design of the levels themselves. Yes, the new Mario games are less challenging than their classic counterparts, but why is it that we now equate more lives to ease of play?
I think because in this game, we've talked about it before, this game in particular heaves lives at you like it's bailing a boat and it's been full of one-up mushrooms. Huh. I mean, the thing about the game is that you have so many lives that the counter at the top becomes a nonsensical, seemingly out-of-place joke. I mean,
well, the stated motivation of the game is to earn 100,000 lives.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's at this point in my playthrough of that game,
no, 10,000 lives.
There you go.
That's, I can't count.
That's more true. Well, I have 231 lives or something like that. I mean, at that point, in the context of this game, especially because when you lose, you get booted out. I doubt the game deletes your save when you run out of lives. Why even have a life mechanic at that point? Why right. care? What point
right.
does the count
that,
off?
That's my problem with it. It's not the number of lives they give you. It's that there shouldn't even be a number. It's just pointless.
Yeah.
It's because the lives become arbitrary, and yet they're held out as this reward for you doing certain things in the game. And it's a non-reward. It's like they might as well just throw a marshmallow at you. Who gives a shit?
It's a total legacy feature.
It is. I mean, Nate's right. It's a legacy feature. They had to implement the 100 coins equals one up. But the thing is, it doesn't make – since Super Mario World, it's not made a difference. I mean, there are checkpoints that I get in that game, I guess. So it makes a bit of a difference. But since they implement – or probably even Mario 3, really. I mean, since they implemented the map – The running out of lives is really a non-issue. You just I'm out of lives. All right, continue. It's just a thing that's there because they feel it has to be there.
It's an appendix that needs to be cut out.
Maybe
that's what I feel about it. But it's not that
Johnny is advocating the removal of all babies' appendixes. Remember, this is the man who said it's like surgery. You just keep doing it till you get it right.
But the funny thing about New Super Mario Bros. 2, though, is that the lives probably play more of a role than they did in previous recent Mario games, because the one-up mushrooms become golden mushrooms when you play them, when you play the levels in coin rush mode. So, in a way, like, when you find the secrets. Yeah, I know. Like, they could have made them golden mushrooms right away, but I don't know. Like, they just wanted to have fun with it. Like, I've got no idea. Who knows what Nintendo is thinking.
They should just make it so you can sell your lives for coins. Like, I should be able to go into the game, into a shop somewhere, and say, all right, Toad, I've got 100 lives. How many coins am I going to get?
That's a great idea. Because at least you're trading one arbitrary item for another arbitrary item that in this game has some meta purpose behind it, you know?
Yeah. Or you could just spend 250 for the Earth. Is it 250 for the level pack? It's all about the gold, and you'll get about 100,000 coins in about an hour. It really is that broken.
Then you're trading a non-arbitrary currency, which is your actual real money, for an incredibly arbitrary currency.
Yes!
That seems like a bad idea.
Not if you're Nintendo.
But yeah, I agree completely with Nathan when he says that the games, definitely 2D platformers in general, should be their difficulty should be judged on the design of the levels. And reviewers have proven to be able to gauge that ever since platformers have started not having one-ups. You know, like, no one called Super Meat Boy easy.
No one said, no. You know.
Like, but you have infinite lives in that game.
Yep.
Oh, okay. Infinite lives. So it's a cakewalk.
Yeah. It's it.
Rayman Origins is the same way. Infinite lives in that game.
Well, Fractured Soul is the same way.
Yeah. That game's hard as balls.
Yeah, exactly.
I quit. I fucking quit that game. I was like,
now you're done?
I don't even want to play this anymore.
Oh.
It's not fun.
But yeah, I don't understand why reviewers are able to judge difficulty just based on the level design in Super Meat Boy. But then when it comes to a Mario game, they're like, oh, this shit is so easy. I've got 100 lives.
Well,
yeah, I didn't read any reviews that said that. I mean, obviously Nathan found one. I think that's unfortunate that someone would be that ignorant.
I do think though that the game is easy. New Super Mario Bros. 2 is, I mean, except
sure, but it doesn't have anything to do with the number of lives it throws at you.
Right? Yeah, no, connecting it to the lives is lazy.
Right.
I would say that I was aware of how easy it was, and that made me amused when I saw my life counter tick up really fast.
Yeah.
Like there was a stage where they gave me 3 1-ups in a row. I'm like, why? What is the purpose? This has no purpose whatsoever. What are you doing? I'm like, great. Thanks, game. Awesome. 3 more lives. Yes.
Did you get a moon?
I didn't get a moon. I'm sad to say. The game itself, I mean, the game itself is easy. The lives are just kind of like a weird way that punctuates it.
Yeah.
That was the ultimate disappointment for me. It was in New Super Mario World. I found that moon thing. And I was like, oh my god, what is that? I can't wait to get it. And I flew up there and got it, and it's a 3-up. Fuck. That's the last thing I needed was 3 more lives. I just found the coolest, most exclusive. I think there's only like 1 or 2 moons in that entire game. And they're really well hidden. And when you find one, that's what you get. More lives. I really think Mario needs to find a better reward structure. If that's how they want to set their game up, where you find something secret and they give you some reward, I think it should be a reward that you actually want.
Well, it's all about the lives.
It might as well be, man. Might as well be. Yeah, I think like in the Galaxy games, it's a total pain in the ass because those games are hard. And you go and you try a level, and you know you always start with 5 lives. If you earn 100 lives, they go away when you turn the game off. So you come back and you have 5 lives, and you go play a really hard level, and you try it 5 times, which is not that many. And if you fail, then you have to like go back to the menus and shit and do a bunch of other stupid crap in order to get more lives just so you can keep trying it. It's actually a real annoyance. And in Galaxy 2, they actually just go far as to say, you know what? If you think you might be dying, just go talk to this Toad and Peach will send you 5 extra lives on top of that.
Here's some lives. Awesome.
It's like,
thanks.
How about you just give me infinity? How about that? How about you just let me play the game rather than go through all this bullshit?
Mario is an unkillable god!
Super Mario Planescape Torment.
Wow.
Wow.
I'd play that.
I think we all would.
Yeah. Straight up. Okay, Guillaume has the next letter.
KSO writes, I bought the Data East Arcade Classics collection on the Wii when the game first came out, mainly because of Magical Drop 3. I enjoyed playing that game with friends in the arcades and enjoy it just as much in the collection. I was surprised to see that the game's value recently shot up in price in the secondhand market, where Amazon vendors are selling the game for at least $50, and some eBay auctions have the game going for over $100. What games have you bought that surprised you in terms of their values in the secondhand market? Also, who is excited for Retro Game Master on DVD? My copy should be arriving this weekend, and I am pumped.
He's hyped. Are you hyped?
Can't you just watch those on Kotaku?
No, they got pulled. They only had a 1-year license.
Oh.
Although I'm sure that those episodes are watchable for free on the internet in some form.
You can find them, yeah. I think he may have recorded like an intro for them.
Oh, cool.
Oh, okay.
You know, I did not order the DVD set, but it just might end up on my Christmas wish list.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah.
That's a fun show. It's really fun.
I mean, I've watched almost, let's say about 2/3 of the episodes in Japanese at this point. Like, a lot of them. I've watched a lot of episodes. And the sad thing is, like, I've played a lot of these games and think to myself, oh god, I know what's about to happen. Oh god, oh no, there it is.
Yeah. Yeah. this show is like made for you, James.
Yeah.
Made for you. It is suffering on screen. It is video game suffering.
The sad part is, like, I've played a bunch of those games that he's played, and I've gone out to get some of those games after I've seen the episode. It's just like, yeah, let's Let's do this shit. Let's go.
Some of them are actually good games. I mean, Ninja Gaiden is a really good game.
He plays fucked.
Like, it's, you know, it's unconscionably evil, but it's an awesome game. I love it.
Oh, a lot of the games he plays are legitimately good. I mean, he doesn't play bad games, or he does sometimes.
Yes, he does. He played Takeshi's Challenge, didn't he?
He did. Oh, but that was more of like a joke what was it? The you use trivia game where he did this weird Japanese pop star trivia game from the mid-90s.
Ugh.
But the funny thing is they would ask about all these Japanese celebrities and he actually knew them. But it would be like, so-and-so is currently married to so-and-so. And then he'd go, nobody, because he got a divorce because then they just do a quick cut because of whatever he said after that.
Okay, so to the main question here. Have you guys ever bought anything that you later found out was really valuable?
Metroid Prime Trilogy? Does that count?
Oh, what is it worth?
I haven't checked. I just know that, like, from word of mouth that it's pretty rare.
Yeah, they did a very limited run of that.
Yeah.
I have that one, too.
Yeah, I don't know what it goes for.
I would never sell it, though.
No, no.
It's just the pure convenience of having all those games on one disc is way too good to have in my collection.
A decent number of my DS games are relatively rare. Radiant Historia for a while was really goddamn rare.
Oh, yeah, but they reprinted it.
They did.
Yeah.
They still didn't print that many, though. I mean, it is a pretty decently rare game.
Right now, the Metroid Prime Trilogy is going for $195 new from Amazon. The lowest used is $70.
The lowest used is $70?
Yeah.
That's just dumb. I mean, it really is. It's just like, it's an insane price.
The thing is,
especially considering you can play those games without having that collection. I mean, that there's little new content on that collection.
Yeah. I mean, that price is bonkers.
I think people at that point are just buying it in order to resell it, and or like they just want the packaging. And I had someone send me, like, he had found a game for $10, but without the box. Yeah, like just in a standard DVD case. And I was like, sure, send it my way. And I got a nice personalized Metroid Prime Gilogy cover for it. So I think
nice.
It was a nice trade up.
That's good.
So it looks like Radiant Historia is going for 30-something online right now.
I don't know. I feel like if I have anything of value, it's purely by accident. Or I just happened to actually buy an Atlas game on the first day and it happened to be, to become rare. I guess that I did get $999 for a good price. And then around the time that it was selling for $50, $60, I did sell it. But now they reprinted it. It's on sale right now on Amazon for $20. So if you're interested in that, do get it.
Huh.
Yeah, it's actually a different cover this time.
Yeah, I bought it like 2 weeks before they did the new cover at like $20.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
I own the Japanese cartridge version of Sin and Punishment.
Oh.
Which for a while was pretty valuable. It was, I remember back around 2000, 2001 when I got it, it was a gift from Billy. And I think he paid considerably less than this. He found a good deal when he was in Japan. But the import price for that game was about $100, which is a lot for an N64 game in 2001. And it was one of the few N64 games that people actually wanted to import. And that's the reason that it was so expensive. But I think the value of that probably dropped a lot when it went on Virtual Console. Which is fine with me. I mean, I own it both ways anyway.
Yeah.
But
and that actually happened with Ogre Battle 64. It used to be worth a decent wad of cash.
Oh, I can imagine.
Oh,
yeah.
Was it the same thing with what was it, Rondo of Blood? And then they put that out in the the PSP collection.
Yep.
Yep.
And Radiant Silver Gun, same thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Of the other DS games I have, I was going to mention 999. It was decently valuable at one point. Radiant Historia and Infinite Space is actually kind of a pricey game.
Oh, yeah.
But weirdly not in Europe. That whole Sega working in Europe thing, backwards craziness sort of comes into play, I guess. Yeah. Johnny used to have a rare DS game in Mega Man ZX Advent, although he doesn't remember it.
I think I must have just traded that in at GameStop for, $15.
If you had just held it for, like, 3 more years, it'd be worth, like, 5 times that.
That's wow. I wish I had. I know one game that it's funny. I bought Earthbound when I was in college. My sister was working at GameStop, so I would get back in my hometown, and so I would get like her employee discount on all this stuff, and so I would go in there and buy a bunch of like used Super Nintendo games for next to nothing. And the one I splurged on is I bought a copy of Earthbound because I'd always wanted to own it. And it was, you know, even back around 2000, it was one of the more pricey used Super Nintendo games. It cost about $50. And I think I spent maybe closer to $40, you know, after the discount and everything. But apparently my copy of Earthbound is now worth quite a bit more than that, like maybe in the $150, $200 range. So that might actually be the most valuable game that I own.
So if we're going to go a bit older, weirdly, StarCraft 64, I believe, is worth an odd amount of money. Like truly odd amount. Like I think it's like $50 for a game that everybody's like, that's not very good.
Well, I would imagine they printed very few of them because it came on a huge cartridge.
Oh, yeah,
it did. So it's very expensive to produce.
But I actually have a bunch of NES games that are reasonably rare, although I can't start rattling them off right now. And actually, I actually inherited from my parents. They're not dead. I was just given it. They're original Intellivision with the voice box, which itself is worth money. Huh. And a completely eclectic mix of games that includes the weird, like, multi-system Star Wars game that wasn't licensed, or was licensed by Lucas, was not licensed by the different hardware manufacturers. So it's worth a boatload of cash. Because for whatever reason, back in the day, you could make games for systems that worked on multiple systems and have a license for none of them.
So do we think that, you know, with going forward, pretty much every title being released digitally only or digitally as well as retail, do we think that the era of being able to resell your precious games for a lot of money is coming to an end?
I think to a certain extent, collectors will still want these games because they are physical objects you can collect. Mm-hmm. I think there is concern about what will forward's compatibility of these digital games look like. You know, in 10 years, will my 3DS eShop or my 3DS eShop games or my 3DS retail games from the eShop be playable on Nintendo's two handhelds of the future?
No, but they'll be playable on your 3DS that you still own.
But see, the difference between a physical copy of the game and a download copy of the game is if my hardware fails, I can try it on a different piece of hardware. On a digital copy, if my hardware fails, it's gone.
Depending on the user account system, you know, I mean, in Nintendo's case, yeah, probably. But that's not true for most other systems.
But will you still be able to download those games? I mean, the Xbox Live is gone for the original Xbox. If you have downloadable Xbox games, they're gone. I don't think you can still get to them anymore.
I'm not totally clear on that. But, you know, I think there will be exceptions. But for the most part, it's true that the resale value, I mean, that's part of the reason that publishers want digital distribution is to get rid of the resale market, mainly for the newer games. I mean, Nintendo loses nothing by these copies of Earthbound going for $200. I mean, it's, you know, if anything, it's good for their reputation probably. But the main reason that Earthbound is so expensive is because that game has never been re-released on any kind of digital platform. Right. And, you know, and there's probably good legal reasons why it never will be. And people know that. And there's a finite number of copies of that game and the batteries go out and stuff like that over time. So that game will increase in value over time. It's just inevitable. But, you know, most games, especially like current games that are still coming out, they're not going to have this. And I think that's fine. I mean, people who are really into collecting games will probably kind of balk at that, but my personal opinion is that people should have access to play the games they want to play for a nominal price. I mean, you know, the publisher should get their cut, but I feel like I don't like the idea of limited quantities. I think video games are an art form, and we shouldn't restrict the number of people who can enjoy that art form to some finite number. I think that's fucked up. You know, and I don't think you should have to be able to go to a museum to play a classic game. I think being able to, you know, deliver that to people who are curious about it is good. Because, you know, as we get farther down the march of time, the number of people who even want to play these old games is going to dwindle. You know, that becomes more and more niche over time. And I think if you care enough to go back and actually want to play one of these pieces of gaming history, then you should be able to.
Yeah, I agree.
I think it's a good thing.
I disagree. You shouldn't be able to play these games.
I don't care for the physical object itself. So if my choice is between overpaying some guy on eBay or, you know, getting Persona 3 easily on PSN for much, much cheaper, then I'll go for the digital download. I get these games to play then.
Sure.
Or, you know, even if it's 2 years too late. But
and even then, at least then your money goes to the people who actually made the game.
Right. Yeah.
Some of it does, at least.
Feels good.
For me, I actually do like having physical copies of games. So, you know, sometimes I'm willing to shell a little bit extra for it. I mean, I have a fairly sizable collection of NES and Super Nintendo games, many of which I bought outside the life cycle of the system because I wanted to have them. You know, it's not Chris Kohler levels of collection, but there is collecting going on. I mean, yeah. I'm not going to make special trips to Akihabara so I can see what games they've got in stock, but I will, you know, go on eBay if there's a game I've been trying to find available for a price that's not ridiculous. I mean, that's why I own a Virtual Boy.
By the way, the Virtual Boy value will go up because that's hardware that is not easy to emulate or reproduce.
No, it's virtually impossible to emulate the effect.
Yeah. And there's a certain number of those, and they break. So if you have one that continues to work, the value will go up and up and up.
Yep, so take the batteries out of it when you're not using it, for God's sake.
They will leak.
Yep.
Eventually, batteries do leak. Okay, well, the final letter is from yet another Nate.
Oh, what awesome. The hell? Why can't more Guillaumes write us?
I'm pretty sure this is a different one. Yeah, all the Guillaumes of the world. please write in. So the next Nate writes, let's speculate on how the gamepad will be used for a moment, the Wii U gamepad. I'm hoping the next Metroid offers a return to the classic 2D gameplay. I want to see an enormous overworld, one that takes 100 hours to fully explore. Take advantage of that HD with a zoomed out camera showing us how small Samus is compared to this vast, desolate alien world. But then on the gamepad, let's have a first-person view of everything that's going on, complete with Prime's HUD and a minimap. Enemies could appear in the foreground, obscuring parts of the environment on the TV, and players would be able to swing the gamepad around and blast them away. Secrets would only be visible in first person, and so forth. So, what do we think of this idea?
Please, no 100-hour Metroid games.
Yeah. It's just impractical. That will never happen. I mean, in order for a game to be 100 hours, it has to be like very repetitive and loosely designed so that you can...
Oh, yeah, because there's nothing repetitive about going back and forth the same area in Metroid games.
I don't think there is. I mean, those areas are designed for that. So they're very densely designed games, and so that limits the length that they can have. I mean, that was like one of the weird shocking things about the first Metroid Prime is how fucking long it was. It was by far the longest Metroid game ever made. And it just seems like the kind of game that it is, it would be really hard to make a game that long. And as it turns out, it was. but they pulled it off. And
yeah, but it was also, in a way, unnecessarily long. I think we all agree that the fetch quest at the end...
There's some padding. Yeah, towards the end, there is some padding for sure.
That was the ripcord moment. It's like, no, I've had enough fucking around hunting for your crap. It's like, you're gonna hide stuff and not tell me where it is. I'm done.
But they do tell you where it is.
Yeah, and that really sucks when you see padding in a game that doesn't need it, you know, in a game that's already plenty long enough. And Skyward Sword, to go back to that, you know.
Yeah. That was,
the game is more than long enough without all this bullshit towards the end.
Or in Skyward Sword, that bullshit started at the very beginning with the... I mean, literally...
I wouldn't go that far.
Well, no, it did. I mean, from the very beginning, every time you had to do the collect the whole droplet thing, that was padding. I mean, that's what that was. That was padding manifest in game design.
I disagree. I think that stuff is a little bit different.
Really? Because
it's a different style of gameplay, yeah.
Style that's not as much fun. Yes.
what strikes me about Nate's idea is that you're tasking the developer with building the world in 2D and in 3D, which seems very, very hard to do. But in a way, Metroid Other M kind of did that already, because you could look in first person all around. It's just that you had to completely stub the action every time. But with this idea, though, like, there's nothing... Like, I guess you could do both at the same time.
in a way.
What you would have is a 3D world with a 3D sprite moving in it, but you'd only see 2D direction. The problem would be in level design, because you have a situation where basically you can really only move left and right. You wouldn't be able to move in and out very easily. So you basically have a world that seems awfully narrow when you're looking through the first person point of view.
Well, or it seems really expansive, and yet you're on a rail.
Yeah, it would. Yeah. Oh,
at that point, you're in a weird way. You've turned Metroid into an on rails game because
you've turned
you can only
Metroid
move
into Final
backward.
Fantasy XIII's first 3 hours. Or whatever.
I was gonna say it turns it into Killer 7.
It turns it into Other M. That's exactly what Other M was.
Well, no, because Other M is a 3D game. I mean, I know people think back to Other M and it feels like a 2D game, but that game is in 3D already. It's just you can either look at it from a third person or a first person perspective.
Right.
I think most of the times when you could move in 3D, it was just battle arenas.
Toshiden?
No, there's a lot of platforming where you can move in and out of the environment. You just don't need to, but you can.
Yeah, this would have
it's kind of a weird half step.
It's been a while since I played it.
Are you saying it's 2.5D in a way we've never contemplated 2.5D before?
No, I'm saying it's 3D.
You should say
I think
that.
I just said literally that. It is a 3D game.
It sounds better.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not. It is, in fact, not 2.5D by the common definition. But James, you are right that the problem with Nate's idea is that you have to design the game in two different ways. You have to design it so it can be played in 2D and 3D. And not only, I mean, that's very difficult from an art point of view, but it's also even more difficult from design. The only game I can think of that really did it is Super Paper Mario. And I think actually that turned out to be kind of one of the disappointing things about it is that it felt almost like a chore. It felt like every area that you found, you had to play it twice, once in 2D and once in 3D. And they were different, but not different enough.
Right.
You know, and it felt like you were kind of just doing the same stuff, but now you have to move left and right a little bit. And the other thing is the 3D environments in that game felt really empty.
Yeah, and that's the challenge you'd face, because if you were to use the same rendering the game in 2D and 3D, you'd have to cut a big chunk of it off so you could see into the world. But even then, you wouldn't be able to populate it with lots of stuff around you, because it would obstruct your view from the 2D perspective.
Yeah.
Right, and I know that my Other M comparison is not popular, but I mean, that game did have always the same halls over and over again, yeah. The same corridors. Yeah. It was not the most artistically diverse game in the series by a long shot.
Hey, the development team of that game is known for their artistic assets.
They're known for assets.
They're known for assets.
I pick my words carefully.
Well played. So, I mean, you know, I do think it's fun to speculate.
It's an interesting concept. It's just difficulty pulling it off. Of course, I still wouldn't want to play it personally. But, I mean, I kind of see where there's an appeal there. It's kind of a weird half-step, though, for trying to appease the Metroid fans who just vehemently want the series to return to 2D. And whatever 10 people bought the Metroid 3D games who hadn't heard of the series before.
Do people vehemently want that? I mean,
there is a subsection of the Metroid community that really strongly, desperately wants a 2D Metroid game.
Well, and I do too, but I don't necessarily want that instead of a 3D game.
I think these people want it instead.
If you go back to the year 2002, we got both on the same day. That was the greatest day of my life. So,
wow.
I want that. I want them to give it to two teams. Let's make two Metroid games at the same time and serve both at not even both audiences, it's the same audience, but let's serve them in two different ways. I mean, that was incredible that happened. So, hey, you know, I want more of that, but I'm not crazy about mixing the 2D and the 3D. I think that's very, very hard to do.
But I mean, like, where do you even find designers who are great at doing both 2D and 3D level design? I mean, I'm sure they exist. They're out there. You think of the good Metroid games in 2D, and you think Intelligent Systems, and what have they done in 3D?
Actually, you know what, Guillaume? You just made me realize the team that could actually mix them together is EAD Tokyo, because Galaxy 2 is a good 3D and a good 2D platformer.
Right, but wouldn't that be a downgrade for them?
Yes.
I mean, I'm not saying...
In terms of sales,
shut up, James.
Yeah.
In terms of games, yes.
Yeah, I was thinking more of, like, revenue and popularity and...
Yeah. It would be kind of cool if they like, swapped and let Retro make the new Mario and EAD Tokyo made the new Metroid. I mean, it'd be fun. I do feel like as great a job as they're doing, I would love EAD Tokyo to do something other than Mario. Because the past three games they've made were all Mario games. They were all amazing. But before that, they made the equally amazing and really, really fresh and never before seen Donkey Kong Jungle Beat. And there's so much creativity there. And I know the Mario games they've made have showcased that creativity. But still, I'd like them to have the chance to break away from the constraints of Mario just a little bit and do something different and then go back to Mario. You know?
And I don't think that giving Mario to Retro would be out of the question. I mean...
No. They made Donkey Kong Returns. I mean,
exactly, yeah. They could do it. Retro has shown that it has the talent. I mean, Nintendo was more protective. Well, no, that's not even right. Like, they do give the Mario license to anyone who asks for it. But
No, anyone who pays for it.
Yeah.
Let's be clear.
But I mean... Yeah, like, Retro has shown that it can do 2D platforming right, so... And their game was not only good, but it also sold a truck ton. So, why not?
And actually, Retro's already worked on a Mario game.
Well, Mario Kart 7. They made some tracks for a Mario Kart game. I think making that jump to saying, well, they've worked on Mario games is kind of a hard sell.
Oh, so these guys made this racetrack. Obviously, they're the right choice to bring donut planes to life.
Yes, I would love that. I would love that. I mean, one of the cool things about Nate's idea is that it really defies what I would expect people to ask for. What, you know, you think, like, what would be nice is if you could get kind of a fairly zoomed in view on the TV where Samus is, like, really big, you know, and the world is just very detailed. And then on the gamepad screen, you see the map, you see the super zoomed out version where you have the context of where you are and how these rooms connect to each other. And instead, Nate's idea was, let's make it super HD on the screen where the resolution is way too big and the characters are really tiny. And then you put the zoomed in view in a sense on the gamepad. And that makes me think of that really horrible, Castlevania
yes,
Harmony
yeah,
of Dissonance.
I was going to bring that up.
Ew, let's not do that.
Yeah.
The really interesting thing about your idea is it reminds me of a terrible game.
Yeah, but it does. I mean,
also,
it's very similar. That was the idea, that let's use these sprites and scale them down to the resolution of HD screens, which makes it so that you can't actually see what's going on.
No. What it was, let's take these sprites and not scale them at all, despite the much higher resolution.
But we can show so much more on the screen. Oh, but that doesn't mean you should. I really do love the idea of just put the map on the screen. I mean, it worked for Castlevania games on the DS. It worked so well. Having that map there where you don't have to pause, you don't have to switch to something else to look at it. Think about how nice that would have been playing Kirby and the Amazing Mirror, to have a second screen that just shows the map.
Or to have a map at all.
What if you didn't have to look for the map, it just was there? I think it would be a nice feature, and other than that, don't get too gimmicky with Metroid, please.
Actually, I've got it. Alright, this isn't too gimmicky, I think. It's a Metroid game. It cuts way back on the amount of backtracking by being an arena fighter. Done. Sell it. Print. Good. End the episode. Wrap it up. Let's go.
And that's going to do it for this episode of Radio Free Nintendo. Thanks to all the Nates for writing this week. if your name is not Nate, then you can send your email for next time.
It won't get read, though.
Right, yeah. I mean, I now have a filter on my inbox, but you can send your email to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. That stands for NateWorldReport.com. And we will get to it on a future episode. And of course, again, you can also go to the show notes at the website, and there will be a link there as well, which a lot of people use. That's why I keep mentioning it, because apparently it's useful to people. Also wanted to mention that the telethon is in full swing for November 10th. Working hard on it, already lining up guests. We're talking about scheduling for content, Hopefully by the time you hear this, the page will be up with a donation link and some sort of basic information about what's going down and what it's all about. That page will grow significantly as we get closer to the event. I'll be adding a lot of new information to it and sort of, you know, revising it as we know more about who's going to show up and what we're going to do. I hope you will go check that out, maybe even bookmark it, because that's the page you're going to go to on Saturday, November 10th to listen to the live audio stream, participate in the chat room, win lots of prizes, and keep on donating to a fantastic charity in Child's Play. So go to the website, please, and look for that. Of course, there'll be a link to it in the article for this episode as well, if it's up by then. And wanted to let everybody know about a couple of podcasts that went up recently. We've got, as promised last week, a new episode of Radio Trivia Podcast Edition featuring our very, very dear friend Michael TYP Cole and the indomitable Zach Miller, and talking about lots of great classic video game music. If you love music or if you love video games, but not both, you should listen to Radio Trivia. Of course, if you love both, you should listen to it as well. And there's also, finally, a new episode of my other show, Discover Music Project. I took a couple of months off from it, just needed a break, but it's back now. And Amanda and I did an episode about Frank Zappa. Holy shit, you've got to hear this. It's some crazy stuff. Really fun episode, and I'm very glad to be back in the swing with DMP. So hopefully I'll be getting new episodes up every, let's say, 3 or 4 weeks, probably slowing down the schedule just for my own sanity. But I do want to keep doing it, and I'm excited to get into more music. And finally, oh, by the way, you can find that on iTunes, that and Radio Trivia. You can find on iTunes, or for DMP, you can go to crosstalk.com with a W. Finally, I thought it would be a good time for us to reiterate our Twitter handles in case people want to find out all the crazy bullshit we spew all week long. So, Nate, what's your Twitter handle?
Well, if you want to follow me for some reason, I am _NAndrews.
Nandrews.
Nandrews.
_Nandrews. Okay. And Guillaume, what about you?
My Twitter handle that I really need to change is Pandarius NWR.
So Pandarius. Pandarus. NWR. And James, what's yours?
Mine would be NWR_James.
Guys with the underscores, man.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it was some kind of weird site thing we had. I also occasionally, although not very recently, operate the real John Lindemann, which is just a Twitter account, John Lindemann.
Yeah.
Yeah. The real John Lindemann doesn't Twitter very often, but when he does, you want to make sure you get it. And I am at Johnny Metz with no H and no Z. Figure out the rest for yourself. Okay, that's all. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with more Radio Free Nintendo.
Bye. Later.
Bye.
Bye. You know, it's really not rocket science.
Cool.
And so,
Sounds good.
Yeah, I'm terrible. It's just, you know, a really, really fun series, and it does most of the things that I... Okay, let's just cut this off.
Sure,
I'm running out of steam. Yeah,
you might be tired.
Yeah, I might be. Cool. I forgot to say that the game is about 45 hours. Like, the Persona 4 took me 45 hours. No, it's not. And now I can stop recording.